This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The International Red Cross Federation says the world is in the middle of an unprecedented period of humanitarian needs because of severity and frequency of shocks and hazards.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details coming up. Also in Nigeria, a Shiite group claims security forces have killed 42 protesters in the capital Abuja over the past 2 days. And South Africa's unemployment rate is on the rise, despite the government's efforts to attract new international and domestic investment. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies has issued an annual report that focuses on the millions of elderly, disabled, and vulnerable victims of natural and man-made disasters who fall through the humanitarian cracks and do not receive desperately needed aid. Lisa Schlein reports from IFRC headquarters in Geneva.
The United Nations reports more than 134 million people are in need of humanitarian aid and protection. In addition, many of the more than 68 million migrants on the move get caught in emergency situations and also need assistance. The International Red Cross Federation says the world is in the middle of an unprecedented period of humanitarian needs because of severity and frequency of shocks and hazards. Millions of people who find themselves in dire straits receive the food, shelter, medical, and other care they require to help them survive and rebuild their lives. Unfortunately, IFRC Secretary General Elhadi Assai says millions of others get lost in the humanitarian system and are left behind. He says those people often have the misfortune of being at the wrong place at the wrong time and are not counted.
These are the stories, you know, of the old lady or the old man in the middle of a disaster that cannot run to a shelter. This is a disabled person that cannot line up, you know, 40 degrees under the shade to carry a 50-kilo bag of rice. This is a child, you know, that is witnessing so many things that a child should never witness.
Sai says many people are out of sight. They are hidden in the shadows of a disaster or inaccessible to those who could help, and so they are left behind. He says millions of people are outside the traditional areas of conflict, disaster, displacement, or disease. And so they too, he says, get left behind. The Red Cross has several recommendations to remedy the serious gaps in humanitarian assistance operations. They include a call for better data on those most in need of aid and greater efforts by governments to prioritize support for people hardest to reach. Secretary General Sai says there should be a major shift in how funds are allocated. He says more money should be entrusted to local and national humanitarian organizations. He says those groups speak the local languages and understand the local customs. He says they are best placed to know which members of their communities are the most isolated, the most vulnerable, and the most in need. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Nigeria, a Shiite group claims security forces have killed 42 protesters in the capital Abuja over the past 2 days. The Islamic Movement of Nigeria says 7 were shot yesterday in the city center and 35 on the outskirts of Abuja on Monday. The police and army have not commented on the killings. The marchers were demanding the release of their leader, Ibrahim Zakzaki. He's been jailed since December 2015 following clashes in the northern city of Zaraya. The 60-year-old cleric and his followers want an Iranian-style Islamic revolution in Nigeria. 8 years after a vendor sparked the Nujda Tunisian revolution by setting himself on fire because of unemployment, an unemployed woman blew herself up on a main road in the capital, wounding 15 police officers. The latest figures indicate the unemployment problem remains, with one-third of Tunisian graduates jobless. Sarah Yarks, a fellow at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, blames the bombing incident on the stagnant economy and the political power struggle that has been derailing the transition to democracy. She spoke to VOA's senior analyst, Mohamed El-Shenawi.
First of all, we don't know what motivated her, but we've seen reports that she was radicalized online, and we know that she was unemployed. And that combined with the figure you just mentioned, that there are so many unemployed youth, there has to be a connection between that. And what we can see is that there is a massive trust gap between the people and the government, due in large part to the failure of the government to make a dent in the huge youth unemployment numbers. And we know that there have been a lot of unemployed youth, and youth in particular, who have been ripe targets for extremists, for radicalization, because they're in this sense of despair and hopelessness.
But Tunisian prosecution spokesperson Soufiane Slaty did not describe the incident as a terrorist attack, while the Tunisian president Qaid Sibsi said it is a clear indication that terrorism still exists in Tunisia. Is there any link to a terrorist group in that incident?
We haven't seen any official link. No group has officially claimed the attack. But what I would say is that what this woman did, blowing herself up, injuring police officers, clearly targeting police officers, targeting the Ministry of Interior, this is an act of terror. She might be a lone wolf. She might not actually be tied to any group. But I think it would be difficult to say that this is not an act of terrorism.
Tunisian economy is still stagnant, and the political environment is witnessing a power struggle. How did the socioeconomic problems and political instability contribute to violent reactions like this incident and derail the transition to democracy?
I think it's clear that the stagnant economic situation is a factor both in this woman's particular case, but also in this sort of general sense of hopelessness and despair among the Tunisian people. You have so many young people who have no job, and also have no prospects for a job. The fact that we're almost 8 years now past the revolution and the economic situation has not improved, this leads to this sense of just complete despair and hopelessness. You combine that with the political environment, which is contributing to this. The fact that the politicians, particularly the parliamentarians, are spending all their time arguing amongst each other, forming new coalitions, quitting one party to join another party, that time is spent fighting, not legislating, which makes it much harder to enact the economic reforms that are going to be necessary in order to really make a positive improvement in the economic and the unemployment situation.
That was Sarah Yarks, a fellow at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. South Africa's unemployment rate is on the rise despite the government's efforts to attract new international and domestic investment. This is bad news for the struggling economy. From Johannesburg, Yasira Ramprasad has the story.
The quarterly labor force survey released Tuesday shows there were 6.2 million unemployed people in South Africa in the third quarter of 2018. In a country with a population of about 57 million people, only 16.4 million are employed. The jobless rate increased to 27.5%, up 0.3 of a percentage point. According to the data, the number of jobs fell in 7 out of 10 industries. Private households, mining and manufacturing showed the largest declines. Economist Kaya Sitole says depressed business conditions in the country are contributing to the increasing numbers of unemployed.
What we face in South Africa is really a long-term problem of an economic system or economic architecture that is really resistant towards absorbing new entrants into the market. And of course, what we're seeing here is that our inability to make the ad market more adaptable to really the crisis of unemployment that we're facing is really problematic. Now, given the small economy that we have, it simply means that the barriers to access become higher, because if the people that are competing for the jobs are that many and there are so few job opportunities, it would mean by default that the people with better qualifications are the ones that are at the front of the line.
Sithole says there won't be a turnaround in the numbers anytime soon.
It'll be very difficult to sort of imagine that this could be turned around. And I think when people try to analyze what the real bottlenecks are, it's really, of course, that if your entire economy itself is not growing, then the capacity to absorb new entrants is non-existent. But also what you're seeing here is that, unfortunately, the South African workforce itself seems to be behind the curve in terms of upskilling itself.
Sithole and other economists say job prospects for now are on the downward trend, with the young people aged between 15 and 24 years the most likely to lose out on employment. South Africa has been in a recession for much of this year, driven by slumps in the communications and transportation sectors, as well as agriculture. In addition, the government is burdened with massive debts that hamper its ability to address unemployment. I'm Yashira Rampasarth in Johannesburg.
15 past the hour, you're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Today, Shea Luketuru is ending her six-year role as the United Nations Special Rapporteur for Human Rights for Eritrea, a country with one of the worst human rights records in the world, because government authorities would not permit Ms. Keturu to enter Eritrea itself to monitor and investigate directly. She had to rely for her reports on testimonies by victims of human rights violations, their family members, witnesses, NGOs, and other contacts. In a conversation last week with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York, Ms. Keturu began speaking about the harassment, intimidation, and arrest of journalists in Eritrea beginning in 2001.
I have documented at least 90 journalists being arrested at some point in their career. For me, I look at it from a human rights perspective. There's no freedom of information. Anything which has to do with reporting arrest and detention of family members or even economic affairs in terms of economic and social rights or with regards to the outflow of refugees, etc.
I understand, though, it's not just journalists who can't gather information freely and disseminate it. It's everyday Eritreans as well.
That's absolutely the case. Debates are restricted. How is the country governed? Do people have a voice to express themselves? Do they have a forum to express themselves, etc.? That forum is closed. That's why I have always said there is little scope for progress in this kind of a situation. There is no constitution. There is no legislative assembly. There is no independent judiciary. There is no independent bar. And I can go on like this.
Morality aside for the moment, aren't human rights violations illegal on Eritrea's part? The country is a signatory to the UN and its conventions.
Yes, Eritrea as a country is a member of the UN, has signed up to several human rights treaties, including the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the Convention Against Torture, as well as regional treaties like the African Charter on Human and People's Rights. And when countries sign up, they voluntarily agree to be bound by these obligations.
I know that military or national service is compulsory for 18-year-olds in Eritrea, and that their term of service is supposed to last only 18 months, but people are made to stay indefinitely, often for many, many years.
Yes, it is quite arbitrary. The Commission of Inquiry on Human Rights in Eritrea has called this enslavement a crime against humanity.
This, of course, brings to mind another human rights violation that Eritrea is accused of, arbitrary arrest and detention. What are the numbers there?
The number of people who are in Eritrea's jails is not documented. And lots of people, they don't have access to lawyers, to their families, etc. And they don't even know when, at times even why they've been brought into prison. And different issues are raised here. Issues around their health and safety in prisons and all sorts of inhumane treatment in the context of detention.
What about freedom of religion in Eritrea?
The right to religion is impacted very negatively in Eritrea. There are four recognized religions: the Roman Catholics, the Eritrean Orthodox Church, Lutheran Church, and Sunni Islam. But that doesn't mean that people have the freedom to practice them freely. The Catholic Church had, for example, six of their clinics closed recently. A Muslim school in Asmara had been at the center of lots of human rights issues, which included girls should not be wearing hijabs and things like that.
I know Jehovah's Witnesses have faced a lot of trouble in the country.
Jehovah's Witnesses, indeed, there have been young men who have been in prison since 1994 because they refused to bear arms.
You paint a pretty grim picture of the human rights situation in Eritrea. As you hand off the job as special rapporteur to your successor, can you offer him any hope?
Yes, there is the potential of peace and respect for human rights, but we need to see this actively and concretely in the actions taken by the government. And at some point, the voices of the people will be heard.
That was Shelu Keturu, the outgoing UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights for Eritrea, speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips. Being an investigative journalist in Africa, where governments are known to threaten and even kill them, has never been easy. But African journalists say they are worried about a threat far beyond their borders. The hostile words of global leaders, they say, make their jobs even more precarious. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Anonymous threats, police harassment, hostile officials, the constant hovering cloud of self-censorship, social exclusion, and forced exile. And to top it all off, low pay. Welcome to the life of a typical African investigative journalist.
There's a tale of repression, assassination, harassment, jailing. It's pretty rough out there.
South African journalism professor Anton Harbour is an organizer of an annual conference that brings hundreds of African investigative journalists to Johannesburg to talk shop and make connections. The journalists have uncovered corruption, human rights abuses, gang warfare, drug and wildlife crimes, and other unsavory dealings. Even among this hardcore crowd, Munugeti stands out. She is a journalist in what is possibly the world's toughest dateline, Mogadishu, Somalia's unstable capital. She writes about female genital mutilation, the seizure and resale of international food aid, and the relentless conflict between militant groups, the government, and Somali clans. Getty says she often gets threats, many of them anonymous.
I think the investigation journalist, as in the world, is always risk, especially in Somalia. It is the risk area. So when you work in Somalia for the investigation journalist, it's not easy.
Reporters Without Borders says Somalia is the deadliest country for reporters in sub-Saharan Africa. Two journalists have been killed in connection with their work this year. Another four were killed in 2017. In Tanzania, the Committee to Protect Journalists says the government has in the past 3 years implemented harsh legislation and harassed journalists and bloggers. Newspaper journalist Kelvin Matandiko says he feels that every day.
It's a shock to different journalists who were experienced to work in free areas like Tanzania. But the currently political regime has become with new changes, and I don't know what is the reason behind, but what we believe that this is going to kill our media industry.
It all comes down, says publisher Dapo Olorunyomi, to integrity. In his notoriously corrupt country, Nigeria, he says sometimes that means shining a light on the threats that come from within journalism itself. He pointed to VOA's recent move to terminate 15 House of Service employees after an investigation found they had accepted improper payments from a Nigerian official.
You know, Nigerians are really very upset about that, I must let you know. Especially those who are doing their job daily, trying to hold public officials accountable in Nigeria. That's a difficult job in itself, not to add this kind of embarrassing situation to it. So we're genuinely upset about it, but I think the VOA management has also done what it must do. It has the right thing to do.
Harber said one of the most worrying threats to journalism lies far beyond Africa's borders. President Donald Trump has described what he called the fake news media as the true enemy of the people. American and international media houses have refuted his words, but Harber says they still resonate globally.
There's no question that dictators or potential dictators here cite things being said in places like Washington to support the view that things need to be done about the media and the way they behave.
Getty, Matendiko, and Olorunyomi laughed out loud when VOA asked them why they like such difficult work. But then, each gave some version of the same answer. Because, they said, people deserve the truth. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Security experts say Africa is increasingly targeted by hackers and must improve its cybersecurity. Churchill Aribodor is the managing consultant of ARC Global Solutions, a firm that specializes in information security. He spoke to reporter Mike Mbonye about cyber fraud in Africa and its implications for the public and for businesses.
Yeah, but it's obviously very true. Africa is a target for cybercrime. The statistics have shown that over the years, and investing in cybersecurity would be in the best interest of the continent and also improve the use of technology. As you all know, technology is fast gaining ground in Africa, and hackers are taking leverage on the weakness in most cyber framework within the country. This is actually a big concern for African continent. So investment in cybersecurity would be the best thing that can happen to Africa. Some African countries are even going far as putting legislation in place, and the legislation will give it, make it also robust to ensure that these investments come and that things are done properly.
Industry leaders at the third African Cybersecurity Conference in Abidjan have suggested that the continent must do something, must invest in cybersecurity, and that Africa seems to be lagging behind. Do you agree with this?
Yes, I agree that Africa is lagging behind, though some sectors have also improved in terms of cybersecurity, especially the financials, obviously because they are more heavily IT dependent for now. But investing in cybersecurity is something both the government, both the private sector needs to come together to do, because the threats are real and the impact is very, very, very high.
What should be done to improve cyber defense in Nigeria?
Okay, basically to improve the cyber defense, one thing is key, awareness. People need to be aware. Within the cybersecurity industry, we have what we call the CIA, Conversational Integrity and Availability. For you to create an atmosphere where cyber defenses will be strong, then the people factor need to be considered. People need to be aware of what and what will put them, endanger them while online, and this is key. So for me, awareness is the most critical thing that needs to be done. Investing in technology is good, investing in processes is good, but the people need to be aware of the common pitfall why using this technology. So if you ask me, I think awareness is key, building strong cyber defense within Africa.
Nigeria lost about $450 million to cyber crimes in 2017, the most common being from fake bank alerts scam. What's your reaction to this?
Yeah, obviously a lot of money has been lost. Those that are the ones that are reported, I am sure it is even more than this. If you compare those that are not reported, it becomes a very concerning issue. Funds have been lost through various means, okay? Even fake SMS alerts is also there. There's a lot of web issues. Data has been manipulated here and there. So if you ask me, the threat is real. It is going to be increasing from various statistics we have seen. If the right investment is not made to ensure that the people, the process and technology are properly implemented to safeguard various organizations and, of course, at large, the nation and the continent at large.
That was Churchill Aribodor, a Port Harcourt-based cybersecurity expert. He spoke with reporter Mike Mbonye in Port Harcourt, Nigeria. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, a look at who really won in the Cameroon presidential election. Guest host Vincent McCoury discusses Cameroon's newly elected president, Paul Biya, and the election that was marred by violence and low voter turnout. Cameroon politics on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.